turning astray of the path that was left long ago. All we leave behind, time after time, is a legacy with nothing to show. Now our country is lost, and it's not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the day?
Hey everyone, this is Steve Donahue, the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. Today's episode is number 106, and what it is a recording of the message that I preached to the church at Mount Tabor Baptist Church this last Sunday. Continuing the three-part series on the Incarnation and the reasons for the Incarnation. So this is give us the last two reasons that we have covered and should be a good show for you. Before I do that, I want to take care of a little bit of business. First of all, make sure that you're a registered user of the website. This enables you to provide feedback through the comment section of each of the comments. It also enables you to have the email updates anytime that there is a change to the website. So anytime there's a new podcast or a new blog post or anything like that, you'll be notified through email so that you can maximize your time and check back when those updates happen and be aware of everything that's going on with Legacy Podcast. Secondly, is make sure that you are telling your friends and family and getting the word out about the Legacy Podcast, helping other people know about us so that we can continue to grow the community and those who might be able to benefit from it. I encourage you to do that. If you have any feedback you'd like to give me directly, the best way to do that is steve@thelegacypodcast.com. That goes directly to me, and I would encourage you to provide me with any kind of feedback you have as to how I might be able to improve the show or anything you'd like to have as upcoming topics, something like that. If you have something you think would be of benefit to discuss, or you have somebody that you'd like me to interview, something like that, it'd be great to consider those things. Pass those over to me at steve@thelegacypodcast.com. And then third is I want to encourage you to visit our sponsors. We have several different affiliates that we have associated with that enable us to be able to get a little bit of a commission each time somebody purchases something from them. And the first of the two that I have for today is U.S. Legal Forms. The reason I like U.S. Legal Forms is because they have the best place that I know of online to be able to acquire the necessary documents that you need to have in place in your folder, your legacy folder or legacy file, to be able to pass on a legacy to your children's children. Everyone should have a will, power of attorney, advanced medical directive, and you can do that pretty easily and inexpensively through U.S. Legal Forms. Just go to their website, download the information you need for that, fill that out, get it notarized, and then put it into your legacy drawer, safety, or wherever you might have it preserved. And then second up is Liberty Classroom. I love Liberty Classroom. It's a great resource for those of you who are homeschooling and have high school students in your homeschool, or if you just want to brush up on American history or U.S. history or any kind of Western civilization or logic or even Austrian economics. All those are courses that are available through the Liberty Classroom. You can watch them online. You can listen to them through MP3. You can download the PowerPoint, or you can have a combination of any of those available to you. And there's quizzes available. You can interact with the professors. It's just a great resource for you to be able to learn U.S. history, Western civilization, logic, and Austrian economics. So check out Liberty Classroom. And then finally, if you like the show and you want to support the show, the best way of doing that is become a legacy partner. I have, in through the end of this year, and starting right before Christmas, a special going on for you. And it's only $10 for the rest for a year membership to the Legacy Partners program. And that enables you to have access to the Legacy Partners page that has discounted material as well as some downloadable material and things for you to benefit from. And I encourage you to take part in that. And again, $10, and that ends December 31st. So if you want to support the show, $10 can do that. Otherwise, it goes back to $30 at the beginning of the year. So check out becoming a Legacy Partner, our Legacy Partner program. And with that, that takes care of the introductory material. So now let's go ahead and listen to the message that I delivered to the church in which I pastor, Mount Tabor Baptist Church, dealing with two more reasons for the incarnation.
Our society, like every other society, is characteristic for having all kinds of superheroes. If you go back to the Greek and Roman world, of course, they had superheroes, demigods, and mythological characters that supposedly intertwined with humans and so created these superhero characters. And of course, in our culture, we have superhero characters. I remember growing up, we had the Super Friends. I don't know if any of y'all remember having the Super Friends on television or having your kids or whatever watching Super Friends. We had Superman and Batman and the Wonder Friend and Wonder Twins. And remember that? The Wonder Twin powers activate and all this kind of stuff. And they'd transform into all these different kinds of characters. And of course, we had Spider-Man. And of course, he's still around. Nowadays, they have the Justice League still, but it's like a Justice League Light is what I like to call it. It's like the kids of the ones that we used to watch. So, like, you know, Superman's got like a son, and Green Lantern's got like a son, and, you know, all these kind of things. And I don't know how that all worked out, but I guess they had to have a new generation of superheroes for a new generation of people or something. But it is customary for every culture to have their superheroes. And the reason for that, I believe, is that because we realize that the troubles and the trials and the tragedies of life cannot be taken care of by man themselves. And so we watch shows like Superman, where he comes in with his superpowers and he's able to destroy the wickedness and the evil of the land. And we naturally have a tendency in our own lives to desire something like that. Somebody who would be able to come in and to take out all the evil, to get rid of all that's wrong in the world, and to establish a real justice and a real truth. And so we create justice leagues and we create superheroes of our own imaginations. But you know, the Bible is really clear in that there was one who came as a superhero, possessing both divine qualities and human qualities, and merging the two so that he might be one and the same in both circumstances, and able to exercise that in such a way that he might be the one who destroys all evil and the one who is able to redeem his people. The last few weeks we've been looking at a series of reasons for the advent of Christ, the reasons for the incarnation, reasons why Jesus came in the flesh to fulfill the purposes of God and what those purposes are. Now I hate to call them theologians, more like skeptics, but there are professors and so-called theologians who actually claim that the incarnation is not a reality. You can read some scientific journals and you can read some even religious journals of the liberal persuasion that will tell you that that is no more real than the idea that some gods back in the Greek and Roman worlds came and had intercourse with human children and as a result of that created some demigod state. But that's far from what the scriptures teach. And indeed what we find in the scriptures is that there is this reality that there was this one who came as an incarnate child in the womb of Mary, grew up and became a deliverer of his people. And so we're talking about Christ today and his work. The last few weeks we've been looking at the incarnation and the necessity of it and what it did and what it accomplished. And one of the things that we talked about was that it was designed to reveal God to us. Another thing we looked at was that he came so that he might be an example for us. Last week we looked at how he came so that he might provide an effective sacrifice for sins. And then we also looked at how he came so that he might fulfill the Davidic covenant. Well, today we're going to look at two more reasons for the incarnation. And the first one is this: the incarnation occurred to destroy the works of the devil. To destroy the works of the devil. Look with me in 1 John chapter 3, verse 8. 1 John chapter 3, verse 8. It says, "He who sins is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. For this purpose the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil." Now it says he who sins here, that is a a continuous action in the original language, meaning not somebody who slips up once in a while and sins, but somebody who is habitually and continually in the process of doing sin. That's what the idea means. And of course, that is the work of Satan himself. That's what Satan does. He cannot do anything other than sin. Even when he appears himself as an image of light, or as he appears himself as an angel of light, he is in that process being deceptive. And so even in that, he is conducting himself in sin. That's what the devil does. He is the originator of sin. His rebellion against God, everything that would contend with God, is founded in the devil. It says, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. Now, originally, we read in the scriptures how Satan was the chief among all the angels. It says that he was actually the most beautiful of all the angels. He was the pinnacle, really, of the angelic order. And he prided himself in that. And as a result of that, he willingly chose to rebel against God, took some of the angels with him, and God kicked them out and made them no longer a part of his hosts in heaven. And as a result of that, he has now been in control of the world until the time of Christ. And so it says, for this purpose the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. Now notice here it says that it is for this reason that he was manifested. It is the first coming of Christ that brings about the completion of the work of destroying the works of the devil. I think sometimes we think that when Christ comes back the second time is when he will defeat the enemy. No, he's already defeated the enemy. It was Christ's first coming that completed the defeat of the enemy. Satan is still operating, but Christ has ultimately defeated him and will one day send him and all who follow him into the lake of fire to be destroyed forever. What are the works of the devil that he's destroying? Well, the Bible lists the works of the devil as follows: sin, rebellion, temptation, ruling the world, persecution, accusation of the saints, instigation of false teachers, and the power of death. And at the first advent of Christ, he destroyed those things. Now the demons believe this, and they tremble. They know that their doom is sure. And it says in Mark chapter 1, verse 23, when Jesus walks into one of the synagogues, that there was a demon-possessed man there. And it says, now there was a man in their synagogues with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, saying, let us alone. What have we to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth? Did you come to destroy us? We know who you are, the Holy One of God. You see, the demons know that their time is limited. They know that doom is for sure. It reminds me of Martin Luther's famous hymn, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. Some of the words in that bring up this picture of the destruction of the enemy by the hands of Christ. It says, A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing, our helper he amid the flood of mortal ills prevailing. For still our ancient foe doth work to seek us woe. His craft and power are great, and armed with cruel hate, on earth is not his equal. Now, if we were to stop the hymn there, we'd think, ooh, not a very good picture. It sounds like we're about ready to be defeated. But he goes on, he says, did we in our own strength confide, our striving would be losing. In other words, if we were to fight against the enemy with our own strength, well, then indeed we would have no hope. Were not the right man on our side, the man of God's own choosing? Dost ask who that may be? Christ Jesus, it is he. Lord Sabaoth, his name from age to age the same, and he must win the battle. Then it goes on, and though this world with devils filled should threaten to undo us, we will not fear, for God hath willed his truth to triumph through us. The prince of darkness grim, we tremble not for him. His rage we can endure, for lo, his doom is sure. One little word shall fell him. You see, Christ came so that he might destroy the works of the devil. And he completed that. He completed that by being the perfect and complete sacrifice for sin and taking that sin to the cross when he died, and then coming out of that cross and out of the death. The incarnation was necessary to defeat Satan because Satan must be defeated in the arena in which he dominates. the arena in which he works presently. And so Jesus came so that he might be in the arena of the realm of the enemy and then defeat the enemy in his own territory. You see, it's very customary for there to be, in the engagement of battle, for one group to try to defeat the other group in their own hometown, so to speak, in their own territory. And so if you go back to every war, if you go back to any war, in fact, you will see this being the case. In fact, if you go back to the war between the states, the Civil War, or the War of Northern Aggression, or whatever you want to call it, depending on where you are and what you believe about the war. But if you go back to those times, why was it that the North tried so emphatically to come to Richmond and destroy Richmond? Because that was where the so-called enemy of the North had its headquarters. That's where they were operating. And why was it that the South tried to move in onto Washington, D.C.? It's because that's where the North had their headquarters. Why is it that during the Mexican-American War, Mexico City was the target of the Americans? Well, because they had to defeat them in their own realm. Why is it that in the Gulf War, Baghdad was the area of the focus of their target? Because they had to defeat them in their own territory. And so it's only reasonable when there is any kind of war that there needs to be a defeat in their homeland. And so when Satan was kicked out of heaven and he was allowed to have the realm of the earth, Jesus had to come into that realm of the earth so that he might defeat Satan on his own territory. And he was able to complete that and to do that when he came in his first advent. You see, what we see now, and certainly we still see evil, we still see destruction, we still see the works of Satan around us. And so some people think, well, he didn't really accomplish what he planned to do. No, he did accomplish what he planned to do. What we see now is we just see the death throes of the enemy. Now, when I say death throes, I don't want the young people to automatically think about the Marvel comic book series Death Throes, where they have the enemies of the superheroes or whatever they're fighting. That's not what I'm talking about. When I think about the death throes, what I think about is I think an animal that is dying and what they do when they die. Now, some of you probably are hunters and you know that when you shoot a deer and it's dying, it doesn't just stop being. It takes some time for it to actually kind of die away. And, you know, we process chickens at our farm and rabbits and things of that nature. And we've all probably heard the expression, he runs around like a chicken with his head cut off, right? You cut off the head of a chicken and that chicken still runs around like it's still alive. But its doom is sure. It's not going to live without a head. And yet it runs around thinking that it's still going to live. Well, that's exactly the situation that Satan is in. His head's been cut off. He's been... The work is done. Jesus on the cross, what does he say? It is finished. The work was completed at the first advent. Jesus came into the realm of Satan and defeated him here. So all that we see now, the evil that we see around us, that's just the death throes of the enemy. That is what Satan is doing. He is experiencing the throes of death. It's only a matter of time, and it will be completely over for him. Now, if Christ came to destroy sin and the works of the devil, then why do we still continue to walk in it? Why is it that we are still tempted by that which is dying away? No, we should put those things off. This also means that through the work of Christ at his first advent, he defeated the powers of sin, rebellion, temptation, ruling of the world, persecutions, accusations of the saints, instigations of false teachers, and the power of death. It's all done. Those things are just a fading, passing existence. Now what we see is merely the death throes of those things. Soon they will all come to an end, and the Lord will come back. I'm grateful for the destruction that Jesus initiated in his first advent, and I look forward to the completion of it in his second advent, aren't you? But secondly, what we see here in the scriptures is we see another reason for the first advent or the incarnation. That is, the incarnation occurred to provide a qualified judge. To provide a qualified judge. In other words, Jesus came in the first advent. He was incarnate in the womb of Mary and became man so that he might be the appropriate and perfect judge of man. John chapter 5, verse 22 says, For the Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son. Sometimes we look at the scriptures and we think, well, you know, God the Father is the one who's the mean judge. You know, we look at the Old Testament, we look at some of the destruction that takes place in the Old Testament. When we look at New Testament, we think, oh, Jesus is a nice guy. He's the nice one. He's the one who is, you know, showing mercy and grace and compassion all the time. And it's God the Father who's the mean old judge, right? Well, that's not true. Of course, they're consistent in their character, right? And so, you know, they're one and the same. They can't be differentiated in that way. But what the scriptures teach is that it's Jesus himself who will be the ultimate judge, who will separate the wheat from the chaff, who will separate the goats from the lambs, who will separate those who are going to the lake of fire to those who are going to be with him in heaven in eternity. He is the ultimate and complete judge. John chapter 5, verse 27, just a few verses down, it says this, and he has given him authority to execute judgment also because he is the Son of Man. You see that? The reason why Christ is given all of the judgment of the world is because he is the Son of Man. Now, what makes him qualified as the Son of Man to be the perfect and complete judge? Well, I think it's interesting that if you look at a good justice system, there are several elements involved. And of course, in our culture, in our society, we have modeled our judicial system after that of the English common law. And that goes back, of course, to some of the laws that we see in the Old Testament and some of that in the Ten Commandments and all of these. And so there's a founding kind of in our judicial system back to biblical roots. And yet our system is faulty in some ways. But if you look at some of the elements of our judicial system, we can see the way in which Christ perfectly and completely fulfills the responsibilities and the obligations of being a good judge. For example, there is a need for a certain particular perspective on the events that take place. That's why we have a jury of your peers. You know why we have a jury of our peers? The way that was originally set up and designed to be was so that, let's say that a farmer does something wrong. Well, he is supposed to have a jury full of farmers, so that farmer can understand the perspective of that person, and that when they come to look at the laws and how that law applies to that person, they'll be able to see it from the perspective of the person on trial. If Jesus had not come in the flesh, he would not have the perspective of man. Now we know he knows all things, right? And yet for our sake, it would eliminate all the excuses. We wouldn't be able to come to God and say, well, you just don't understand what it's like to be man. No, he understands fully what it's like to be man. He has that exact same perspective. The same reason why there is a jury of the peers is the same reason why Jesus came in the flesh, so that he might be the perfect and complete judge and judge justly. Also, we see that judges need to have a sound understanding of the law. You can't just wake up tomorrow and say, you know what, I think I'm going to be a federal judge. Go right down to the courthouse and start. You can't do that. You've got to go get an undergraduate degree, then you've got to get a good juror's doctorate and law school and pass all the bar exam, and then you've got to be experienced in practicing the law. You've got to be able to have some trials under your belt. People be able to see that you're established and understanding the law and applying that law in certain situations. Right? Wasn't that exactly what Jesus did? In fact, when he lived on this earth, the lawyers of the day came to him and said, the law says this, what do you think? And time again, what does Jesus do? He baffles them with his understanding of the law, doesn't he? He makes judicious decisions about the case that they're bringing to him. And he makes them go away speechless because of his understanding of the law. And so he's able to have a perfect understanding of that law. But thirdly, they need to be tested and proven to be experienced in handling the law. And so this goes hand in hand with what I just mentioned, that they need to have a sound understanding of the law. Sound understanding of the law. He was the one who created the law itself, isn't he? Scriptures say that he and the Father are one, and the Father is the one who created the law. And so he himself knows. Who better to understand the law than the one who created the law? Who better to then interpret the law as the one who is actually able to live out underneath the law? And so hand in hand, Jesus is able to do this. And then fourthly, they need to have some connections so that they can be appointed to the courts. I think sometimes we think in this world that someone becomes a federal judge because they just are exceptional in their practices. Do you know federal judges are appointed by politicians? Now, they're supposed to be impartial. We know that, right? It's impossible to be impartial. And so any time that you are appointed by, let's say, a Republican, don't you think you're going to have a little bit more persuasion towards the Republican bent? Or if you're appointed by a Democrat, don't you think you're going to have a little bit more legal persuasion based upon the Democratic bent? Of course. And so they have some kind of connection to some politician or politicians or groups of politicians that allows them to be appointed in that position. Now, here's the good news. Jesus is one with the Father. What better connection can someone have? You see, he has a perfect connection with the one who's actually overseeing the whole affair. And so he's able to be the perfect appointed judge over the case, over our situations. And then fifthly, judges are to be impartial. Now, I've already addressed that it's impossible for them to be impartial. And they're supposed to judge only based upon the law and the case that is before them. And of course, that never happens. There's much more to it than that. And so we know, though, that the scriptures say that Jesus was impartial. It says that he does not look at the face of man, but he judges based upon what? The heart. So he has perfect judgment. So he came in the flesh so that he might be able to fulfill all the requirements necessary to be a perfect and good and qualified and complete judge. Aren't you thankful that we have a judge who knows what it's like to be human, but also is able to judge perfectly as God over the laws of man? Based on this perfect judgment, some will be given mercy and others will be given justice. I'm glad that based upon what the scriptures say, I'll be given mercy and not justice. No one can escape the judgment of the Lord. The good news is that his judgment will be perfect and that his perfect judgment will be provided in a way so that there might be an escape for those who put their faith in him. You know, on Christmas, we celebrate the great mysteries of the truth that Jesus came in the flesh, that he took upon himself human nature so that through that human nature he might fulfill the work that God has set him to do. Sometimes it's difficult to understand this, and yet the scriptures teach it. One of the early church fathers, Chrysostom, wrote this. It says, "I do not think of Christ as God alone or man alone, but both together. For I know that he was hungry, and I know that with 5 loaves he fed 5,000. I know that he was thirsty, and I know that he turned water into wine. I know that he was carried in a ship, and I know that he walked on the sea. I know that he died, and I know that he was raised the dead, and that he raised the dead. I know he was set before Pilate, and then I know that he sits with the Father in his throne. I know that he was worshipped by angels, and I know that he was stoned by the Jews." And so we see over and over again in the scripture this idea that he is both fully God and fully man. And the reason for that is so that he might be able to accomplish the work like no one else can. He is indeed far better than any superhero that we could ever begin to imagine or conjure up in our own minds. He is perfect and complete in that way. We have looked at the 6 reasons for the incarnation over the past few weeks. Reveal God to us, to be an example for us, to provide an effective sacrifice for us, to fulfill the Davidic covenant for us, to destroy the works of the devil, and to be a perfect and qualified judge for us. So what should we do? I've got 3 very concrete things that we can do. Number 1, believe in the incarnation. It's not a myth. It's not something that is just made up by man. It's the truth. And we can believe it. Secondly, thank God that he has sent Emmanuel, God in the flesh, Jesus, so that he might make all these things possible. And then 3, don't minimize the importance of the incarnation by cluttering up the celebration of it with all kinds of other distractions. It's real easy to do at Christmas time, isn't it? It's real easy to get caught up in all the activities of the day and the secular holidays and everything else all around it. We can't let that happen. Instead, we must continue to focus on the centrality of the incarnation and what that means for us. Let us pray.
And with that, this has been Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. What will you do today to build your legacy?
Now our country is lost, and it's lost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? But just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Change your legacy. What will you do to change?